Over the weekend, millions of Americans had the opportunity to sign up for health insurance as the annual enrollment window opened for coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Last week, University of Minnesota political scientist Lawrence Jacobs traveled to Oklahoma City.
The sense of, grab your pitchfork and let's, take out the Affordable Care Act, that's no longer there.
He also contended both state and federal officials nationwide are broadening their horizons beyond any original goals when it comes to the future of health care.
The real question that we need to be thinking about is what kind of reform are we going to be looking at?
This is Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Brian Hartzinski. We'll hear Lawrence Jacobs' presentation from last Monday's Oklahoma Policy Institute luncheon right after this hour's news from NPR. You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Brian Hartzinski. A week ago, political scientist Lawrence Jacobs spoke during a luncheon at the Jim Thorpe Association and Oklahoma Sports Hall of Fame in Oklahoma City. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota. The talk was presented by the Oklahoma Scholars Strategy Network and the Oklahoma Policy Institute.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's like a break from winter in Minnesota. We have two seasons. We have winter and we have road work. That's the second season. And road work is over and winter started a couple weeks ago. So thank you very much. This is a tough topic, health reform, and I want to talk about where we're heading on health reform. But I was thinking as I was coming in last night of the kind of modesty you need to talk about where we're going in this country with health reform. And I was thinking of one of the odd governors in Minnesota, not Jesse Ventura, a guy named Rudy Perpich, who believed in the afterlife and your ability to kind of, through seance, communicate with the afterlife. And we kind of hoped his policy decisions weren't driven by the afterlife. But Rudy was out one time campaigning. And, like a lot of politicians, it's a day or two before Election Day. They got a caravan going through part of the suburbs, and the first car goes into a senior's home and, gathers people in a circle. And then Rudy comes up, and he walks in, and then the next car comes and makes sure people get to the polls. And so Rudy pulls into one of these senior's homes, and there's a circle of people over in the open area. And he walks in, and he sees a gentleman sitting off to the side in a wheelchair, glasses, respectable sort of guy. And Rudy walks up to him and says, "Do you know who I am?" The gentleman looks back seriously and said, "No, but if you ask the nurse, she'll know who you are." And I think, sometimes in health reform, there's a little bit of that going on. I want to talk about a couple different themes that I see as pretty important in thinking about health reform and where we're going in the country. And to be candid with you, it's not where we've been. I think we're at a shift. We're not going to have a guy named Obama on the campaign ticket again. And I think the conversation and the politics of health reform are already changing dramatically, and I want to kind of talk about that a little bit. The first thing I'm going to talk about is the honey badger. The honey badger don't care, except if he's finding honey. And there's a very interesting change that's going on with public opinion and health reform. There's a little bit of a honey badger about it. If you look at overall public attitudes, we've seen a very consistent pattern of more people having unfavorable views of Obamacare or health care reform, the big abstract thing, since it was passed. It's down a little bit over the last couple months, but it's still a consistent pattern. What's striking about this is when you get into the guts of what the Affordable Care Act actually did, guarantee issues so you don't have pre-existing conditions, filling in the donut hole on prescription drug benefit coverage through Medicare, the provision that children can be covered up to 26 in their parents, health insurance, the provision of subsidies, all those things and more are supported by well more than 60% of Democrats, independents, and Republicans. there is vast support for what it is that health reform is doing and has been organized to do. There are a couple issues there. One is that the partisan lens has kind of given this a cast that we all are familiar with. The other is that most people don't know actually what the Affordable Care Act does. And there are lots of ways to show you this. There's a study that was recently done by a group at Stanford that really dug in on what people know and its relationship to support. And basically what it shows is the more people know, whether you're a Democrat, independent, or Republican, the more supportive. So for a Republican that's quite opposed to the Affordable Care Act, as they get more knowledge, you move up towards about half supporting it. And among Democrats, as you'd expect, you move up to almost universal support. And among independents is also you move up close to 80% support. So where are we heading on this? Well, if you look at the projections, and these are projections from the Congressional Budget Office, nonpartisan, it's what kind of everybody uses. Congressional Budget Office has been projecting and tracking enrollment in the health insurance exchanges. And when the law was passed, they said, well, 6 million people will be covered as a result of the open enrollment beginning in 2013. Well, they were off a little bit. There were a little bit more than 8 million who actually ended up signing up. But the key point I want to convey to you is that by the time Barack Obama is leaving office, the CBO is projecting 25 million people on the exchange, an additional 12 million covered by the expansion of Medicaid and the Children Health Insurance Program. And then you add in a couple other things, like the expansion of insurance coverage for those who are under 26, and some employer-sponsored health insurance. And you're getting up close to 50 million people. Now, 50 million people is the size of a bunch of European countries. This is a large number of people. And as people, and we know this from other programs like Social Security, as people come to know a program and experience it, or there's someone in their family who experience it, they get to know that program. This is no longer abstract. You've got to read in the paper or get some pamphlet that's got a lot of fine print. This is something it becomes part of your life. And so when I talk about knowledge being related to support, this is the trajectory. And it's one of the most important elements of the change in health reform. This is from an exit poll, a national exit poll, looking at attitudes towards health reform. Again, this is from Tuesday night. And the most striking thing here is, I was telling you about how there was kind of a tilt towards unfavorable rather than favorable. Voters who went to the booth were pretty much split between those who believed the Affordable Care Act went too far and those who felt that it was about right or didn't go far enough. In fact, a quarter of voters said they didn't think the Affordable Care Act went far enough. Now, that is not the country being kind of up in arms about health reform. That, to me, says there's a shift going on, and I think that shift is going to continue. Minnesota is part of the United States of America, of course, but the election results were not didn't really fit with the pattern we saw around the country. And one of the things that was really very interesting, and I run a nonpartisan center. I work a lot with business community and Republicans and Democrats. I don't have an axe to grind here. But one of the things that my Republican friends told me when I would talk to them privately, and then you would see this in their campaigns, is the belief that the fact that the Minnesota health insurance exchange failed. It is not working. There are a lot of reasons why we've gotten to about 200,000 people, 300,000 people enrolled, and most has to do with Minnesotans being patient, waiting 3 hours on the line to talk to a call center, and the health plans being pretty heroic, and some civil servants who were smart and found workarounds. But what was striking is, despite the failure of the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange, known as MinSure, it didn't play a role in this election, despite all the ads about it. In fact, approval and disapproval, like what we saw nationally, was about even. And even among those who disapproved of MinSure and the way the governor handled it, voted for the governor and for Senator Franken about 1 out of 5 times. So my point here is just that the nature of public attitudes towards health reform is changing. Now, the other element of this is repeal, which we are going to see proposed in the new Congress, and it will almost certainly be passed. But what I want to tell you about it, and this is polling from the Kaiser Family Foundation. You can go online and look at it yourself. There are other, you know, independent pollsters out there. You see almost two-thirds of Americans, including substantial majorities of independents, saying that they do not believe that the Affordable Care Act should be repealed. They'd rather see that work go into improving the law. And so I think we're going to see a symbolic vote on the Affordable Care Act, but I think this reality and this shift that's now going on in the way in which voters and Americans are looking at the Affordable Care Act and the fact that the name Obama is going to be passing into the history books within a few years. In fact, maybe even within the next 2 years, as I think his role will downgrade. Now, the next thing I want to talk about, I told you public opinion is shifting. There's less the outrage. There's more acceptance. There's a sense of, yeah, the thing hasn't worked very well, but let's find a way to fix it. And by the way, I think that can be done in a bipartisan way. I think there are areas where there is broad agreement about areas that can be improved. But the next issue is, where will the action be? And a lot of the headlines are going to be about the repeal vote in Congress and kind of the big battle. But I've got to tell you, as someone who studies this during my waking hours, when I'm not watching Minnesota football, or Adrian Peterson when he gets back in the field, the action is really in the states. And this is one of the cases where you kind of look around the country and there's a lot going on. This is looking at the health insurance exchanges that have been adopted. And as you know, just a bit more than a dozen of the states have fully operating health insurance exchanges. It's much less than the reformers expected. You've got 36 states who have not. Now, that's the kind of the top line story. But it's very interesting because the vast majority of states are involved in running these exchanges. And so if you look at, there's a kind of a new category that's now used in the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid called supported state-based marketplaces. And right now there are three states in it, Oregon, which tried to start a state-based exchange and it failed, and now they're using the federal IT system. You've got Nevada, where you've got a Republican governor who pushed it through, and you've got Idaho, a very red state, who've pushed it. And there's a growing number of states who are moving into this, who are about to move into this category. And the category are states that use the federal exchange for eligibility and enrollment determinations, and the insurance market operations, the plan management, goes on within the states. And obviously, if any of you involved in the insurance markets will appreciate the fact that you sure as heck don't want federal government running your insurance markets. This is something that states have done forever, and there's quite a bit of capacity to do that. And so this is really the direction I think we're probably heading in. The reality is that the vast majority of states are very active in these exchanges, whether you call them this new category or just a federally facilitated marketplace, you're looking at state involvement. Now, we can talk in a moment about the Supreme Court case that they just put on their docket on Friday, which is aimed at the subsidies. But what I just told you, that will become the reality as we move forward, because a lot of the headlines have been about the threat to the entire Affordable Care Act because of the possibility the court will strike down the Obama administration's regulatory ruling that the subsidies can be applied to people in the federal exchange. It's a large number of people. But what I want to tell you is that's only part of the story, because the states are so involved right now that I'm looking for the federal government, and I can tell you that I've heard some of these conversations about creating even more flexibility for states to sign up. For instance, it could be as simple as a governor writing a letter, rather than going through what we've seen in the dozen or so states of legislature passing laws and that whole kind of gut-wrenching experience. So this deep level of state involvement is going to become a key element in the response if there is a Supreme Court ruling against the subsidies, which I do not take as a foregone conclusion. We can talk more about that. Okay, so the exchanges are one part of health reform. The other part is Medicaid expansion. And what's most striking here is you now have a majority of states that have expanded Medicaid. And this is a historic moment because, of course, before you had Medicaid determinations based on state eligibility rules. And in some states, you had the poverty line that triggered eligibility set at a quarter of the poverty line or even a bit less. It was quite striking. The Affordable Care Act created a national standard. It's up to 138% of the federal poverty line. And you've got 28 states and the District of Columbia who've made that expansion. Now, here's what's interesting. 16 of those states have Republicans playing a role in the government in some way, governor, some part of the legislature, or entire, Republican control of the government. So this is moving forward, and frankly, as I look at the history of Medicare and Medicaid, which started in 1965, we're about on track or even ahead of the expansion of Medicaid when it was passed in 1965. We're just 4 or 5 years into this process. We're kind of in the infancy of this. My expectation is that Medicaid will continue to expand. The kind of pragmatic issues about how do you fund safety net providers and hospitals, state budget issues about covering uncompensated care and other issues will come to the fore in other states apart from or in addition to these 16 Republican states that have moved forward. The other element that you don't hear a lot about in Medicaid, in fact, I doubt many of you have heard about this, is what's known as Medicaid modernization. It's a streamlining process in making Medicaid determinations that's done through online databases. So in the old days, that is before 2010, you needed to bring, if you were going to apply for Medicaid eligibility, you needed to bring a piece of paper demonstrating your eligibility to an office and then get clearance and walk through that process. As part of the Affordable Care Act, there's a process, it's known as 90-10 because the federal government picks up 90% of the cost, that has created a whole new IT system. It's paid for the administrative upgrading. This is converting, and this, by the way, is being done in almost every state. It's being done by Medicaid directors. Often the governors don't even appreciate what's going on. In Texas, an enterprising reporter dug up what I just told you and went to Governor Perry and said, how come you're implementing Obamacare? He's like, never. I'll never do that. Well, it turns out his Medicaid director modernized Medicaid. It was a non-political administrative decision, and it's having a very significant impact. If you look at the enrollment in Medicaid around the country, including in states who have not signed on to the Affordable Care Act, it's increasing. So the Medicaid element of health reform is moving forward. I would say it's making reasonable progress. And when I talk about almost 50 million people being enrolled in some element, this is a big part of it. Now, with some colleagues, we've been doing research trying to explain the expansion of Medicaid, including into these Republican states. And obviously, partisanship is a very robust factor. But we're also finding other sorts of influences on the decisions of states with regard to expanding Medicaid. Should we do it? Should we not do it? One element is simply the history of the state with providing coverage for vulnerable populations and building the administrative capacity to have the wherewithal to be able to actually get the job done if you sign up for it. Another factor is familiarity with the federal government's waiver process and the idea of bargaining. Is the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid expansion a take-it-or-leave-it proposition? The federal government is jamming this down our throat. Or is it an opportunity to go back to the federal government and say, no, we're not going to do this. Here's what we'll do. And a lot of those Republican states and some of the Democratic states have done just that with the federal government. And they tend to be states who've had some experience negotiating. Arkansas, for instance, who's been a pioneer in what's known as the private option in adopting Medicaid reform. Extraordinary story. You had a Democratic governor. He's gone. But you had a Republican legislature and a set of constitutional rules that said three-quarters of the legislators need to vote for any bill that will spend tax money on new programs. You would think, forget it, that's not going to work there. Well, they framed it as a private market-oriented approach. They took some of the money that was going to be freed up in the budget and put into tax cuts, and they passed it. And it's a remarkable effort, but it resulted from, or stemmed from, very tough negotiations between Arkansas and CMS. Arkansas said, we will not do this. Here's what we're willing to do. And the federal government came back and said, that's not something we're willing to do, but how about this? And back and forth and back and forth. You never read about it in the papers, and other than me talking about it right now from the conversations I've had with the people involved, you're probably not going to hear a whole lot about it. But that's what we're seeing going on. States that have experience bargaining with Washington and trying to get their way seem to be making more progress and faster progress in Medicaid adoption. The other factor that's starting to emerge more recently are the impact of public interest advocates. Where they're present, they seem to be having some influence. And these are, you know, kind of pretty robust statistical models that we've been doing. Now, I've told you a bit about the kind of changing politics of and contours of health reform with regard to the exchange and Medicaid. I've told you about some of the shifts in public opinion. I want to turn to the elections, because elections and lawmaking are obviously two sides of the same coin. And what I'm seeing in terms of electoral shifts, I think, are pretty significant. One of the most important questions to ask when we're looking at statewide and national elections is which electorate is going to turn out. And we have very different electorates to turn out on midterm elections, like on Tuesday, versus presidential elections. The general pattern, we can go into more detail, is that for presidential elections, you have an electorate that tends to be younger, more minority, less affluent, less well-educated, and a bit more Democrat and liberal than in midterm elections. Midterm elections, you see something very different. You see older, whiter, more affluent, and more conservative. And so the results that happened on Tuesday around the country, with the exception of Minnesota, for the most part, fit this pattern. One of the main points, this is actually one of my favorite factoids. This pattern that I'm pointing to is accelerating. We're not like at a kind of pause. This is not the way things will be. It is going to get, the change is going to become even more striking. This is from a Pew Research Center study, and you could see these numbers in any number of places. But what it shows you is the change that's going on in the country. Seniors are going to become a larger part of our population by 2015. You knew that. White population is going to shrink by about a third to a half. Hispanic population is going to double, more than double. African-American population stabilizing. Asian population almost doubling. Foreign-born population increasing by about 50%. That's where America's going, and here's why it matters. This is looking at the proportion of the white vote in presidential elections. 1980, Ronald Reagan won a landslide election, carried almost every state, and he had 55% of the white vote. Now, you shoot ahead to 2008, John McCain had 55% of the white vote and lost substantially. 2012, Mitt Romney actually had more of the white vote, 59% of the white vote, and he lost not quite by as much as McCain, but he lost decisively. What's the difference here? Well, the difference is you've gone from an electorate that's almost 90% white to an electorate that's approaching 72% white. And that pattern is going to accentuate. So that disjuncture I was talking about between midterm and presidential elections, it's going to become even starker, and midterm elections may change as well. So what does this have to do with health reform and Washington? Well, I want to kind of bring this back to this issue. 2014 was a challenging environment for Democrats running in the Senate. You saw six Democrats running in red states, Louisiana, Arkansas, Alaska, and elsewhere. Shoot ahead to 2016, there are no Democrats running in red states, but there are seven Republicans running in blue states, like Pennsylvania and other sorts of blue states like that. Now, that's going to have an impact on the way in which people start in Washington, start thinking about some of these policies. This is a very important element of what I think we're going to be seeing playing out in Washington in terms of the effort on health reform, and it ties up with this change that's going on in the electorate. We think of the Democratic-Republican battle. It's huge. Polarization is as wide as we've seen it since the Civil War. It's huge. But the divides within the parties are also very significant. And this is going to be particularly important on the Republican side. So when you think of the Republican majorities in the Senate, what we also need to be thinking about is the ideological split between the very conservative elements, Ted Cruz, element, and the more pragmatic conservatives. In the House of Representatives, there were a gain of about a dozen seats, and most of those new Republicans coming in are more conservative than the Republicans who had been there in the last session. You can remember this was the session where we had a near car crash on raising the debt, which is not something we've had before. Similarly, on the Senate side, we're going to have a split between the Ted Cruz wing and the more moderate set of pragmatic but conservative Republicans. And this is just a ranking of the conservative score from the last 2 years. And this is going to polarize even more within the Republican Party. This is just making the same point. I want to talk for a moment about where we're heading, I think, in terms of the Affordable Care Act moving forward and some of the different scenarios that we're looking at, giving thought to this new public opinion, the new politics as we're seeing it emerge in the states, and in terms of this change in electoral patterns. One scenario that's quite real is repeal and collapse. And there are reasons to think this would happen. As I mentioned, Congress and the Republicans have shifted to the right. Ted Cruz, even though he's isolated to some real extent among his colleagues, still has enormous influence. And there will continue to be substantial headaches with the Affordable Care Act and its operations. We could spend quite a time talking about what's coming there, and some of it is going to be real problematic. We're going to see votes coming up within a few months that are going to be dramatic and point in a very different direction on the Affordable Care Act. For sure, we're going to see repeal come to the floor and almost certainly pass. We're going to see efforts to stop funding or to substantially reduce funding for the Medicaid expansion and for the subsidies. And there's going to be efforts to defund the Obama administration's implementation of the Affordable Care Act. All that is going to happen. I think it's probably unlikely to happen, partly because of this change in public opinion, partly because of this kind of more difficult political environment heading into 2016. What I think is more likely is questions about what type of Affordable Care Act are we going to see moving forward. I think the idea of repeal is old. That is coming off a campaign trail. The real question that we need to be thinking about is what kind of reform are we going to be looking at? And I think there are two models. One is a kind of reform in which there's incremental change that is tailored to the pressure of the organized. And this is an old story in Washington and in our states. The effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act may well produce a backlash. In political science and political psychology, we refer to this as loss aversion. People are not always that sensitive or appreciative of gains, but you try to take something away from them, and they're mad as hell. And as you start to, I mean, those lists of things I mentioned were very popular. Those are now part of people's lives, or they expect them to be part of their people's lives. And I think we're going to see, issues about alarms going off about hurting women, hurting the poor, and threatening seniors, and that sort of thing. We've heard that before. Then I think when you look to the kind of healthcare industry, businesses, insurers, providers, and I would include AARP in that, there's going to be a big effort to stop repeal. That's very interesting. There's been a shift in the stakeholder community from before 2010 to today. Why? Because, one, the Affordable Care Act has turned out to be very profitable when you look at the stock market returns. It's also people have invested tens of millions of dollars in new models. In Minnesota, we've got the United Health Insurance Company. It actually doesn't practice in Minnesota, even though it's based there, because it's a for-profit company, and in Minnesota, only nonprofit insurers are allowed to operate. But United Health, good times. They're making a lot of money, and they're quite happy. They'd like to be making more money, of course, but they're not in the mode of repeal any longer. They're in the mode of how can we get accommodations? And I think we're going to see a lot of efforts to get those accommodations, including efforts to end or delay the medical device tax. I can tell you that both Democratic senators in Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar and Al Franken, list this as one of their top objectives, and they're joined by a whole bunch of Republicans on it because we've got places like Medtronic in Minnesota, and we've got a lot of jobs tied up in that. There are other elements of the Affordable Care Act that I think will be threatened or terminated that the stakeholder community is not that happy about. There's also going to be a lock-in of benefits for better organized and vocal groups like seniors and middle-class folks and others. I think there'll be pressure on the Obama administration regulators to provide states more flexibility. So far, they've driven a pretty hard bargain, but I think that's going to relax for folks in Oklahoma. I would expect even more accommodation from Washington in this new period. Here's the last thing I want to tell you. Next to last thing I want to tell you. There's also a second possibility in the Affordable Care Act, which is a kind of slingshot forward, where you've got Democratic hopefuls, you've got allies who, looking to 2016, see a return in coming out of the hills and the crouch position that a lot of Democrats have been on Affordable Care Act and actually campaigning on it, on this theme of benefits being taken, on different groups being hurt, groups that are well-organized and that tend to turn out and vote. We may also see a split that makes the Republican majority less effective than one would suppose after Tuesday night's results. You're going to have a split between the presidential hopefuls, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Rubio, Paul Ryan, the list is long, and the Republicans who tend to be more moderate or up for election in blue states. We also have this issue about the health reform encompassing perhaps 50 million people. That's going to start to sink in. One of the interesting models that Democrats are talking about is the Saskatchewan model. Now, you folks down here in Oklahoma don't think about Canada. Sometimes Minnesota is referred to as the other province of Canada, so we're pretty sensitive to the Canadian arrogance. But, you know, you kind of look at health reform in Canada, and what you would see is that there was one province, Saskatchewan, who first create a hospital insurance program, and then it's picked up by the national government. This is just after World War II. About a decade later, they create a universal health insurance program for the other costs. It's then picked up a few years later by the federal government. And we're going to see in the coming years, before President Obama leaves office, what's known as a 1332 waiver. And it creates opportunities for states to pursue other models. Now, some of those models are going to be market-based, and I think Utah will be out of the box with one that's more market-based. But you also have Vermont, which has already passed the single-payer legislation. They're into the weeds on how would you implement this. And they are into conversations with the Obama administration to get a 1332 waiver. California is talking about a public option as a 1332 waiver. So when health reform comes up on the agenda again, it's going to be a broader range of options than what Massachusetts was doing. It's going to be a robust set of options. Some of them will be kind of on the more conservative end, and then there will be a whole bunch on the progressive end. The last thing I'll just close with is, you know, we tend to get kind of very short-term oriented in the way we think about politics, but I can tell you that if you look at Social Security, it's humbling. Passed in 1935, 4 years later, the program's almost dead. The financing was terrible. It was actually hurting the economy and pushing the economy into another recession because of the way the financing was done. The benefit structure was not well worked, and President Roosevelt had to go back to Congress to redo it. Imagine if Barack Obama did that. I mean, it's just it really was not working. And then it was suspended during World War II for obvious reasons. And then after World War II, there were a group of people that said, it didn't really work. why continue this thing? I mention that because it was all about turbulence and a conversation about repeal and a lot of conversations about, is this thing actually operational? But beginning in the 1950s and 60s, you begin to see a bipartisan majority that turned Social Security into the third rail of American politics, such that near 50 million people who will be affected by and covered by the Affordable Care Act, those kind of people began to create a new coalition in the electorate. Let me stop there, take some questions and comments, outrage, whatever you got.
Hi, I'm Steve Goldman with the Oklahoma Primary Care Association, and I'm also a navigator, so I've had the chance to go out and talk with a lot of Oklahomans, and so I was very intrigued about your sense of a groundswell of support for the Affordable Care Act, and wondering what experience is in other states of folks coming to a public acceptance of the ACA. A lot of the folks that I talk to say, this works out really well for me, but I don't know whether it's okay to tell my friends. And trying to connect the marketplace with that whole Oklahoman sense of independence. I pick my own insurance. Right. Right. I go out and start my own little company and get insurance for my family. But the political veneer and the religious veneer on Oklahoma has been one of the things we're working through. What experience has been in other states in terms of any sort of public groundswell that politicians feel that the ACA is something to keep?
I think groundswell is probably too strong. What I would say is the sense of, grab your pitchfork and let's, take out the Affordable Care Act, that's no longer there. And I see it more as a kind of, opinion is kind of now split. And I think it's more and more split evenly. The point that I really think is important to focus on is as people get these benefits, as we move to 50 million people covered, knowledge about the program goes up. And it becomes less about Obamacare and this very abstract, polarized headache called healthcare reform, and more about, wow, my kid's going to get health insurance coverage after she leaves home. It's about my mom, who's now got actual reasonable drug coverage through Medicare. It's all these elements that people have not really understood and to be honest, still don't understand. But that's changing, and you can see in the polling data this shift. And I thought it was just very striking on Tuesday, which was a terrific night for Republicans. Voters were still split on the Affordable Care Act. You had about the same number of people saying they thought that the Affordable Care Act was about right or didn't go far enough as those who felt that it was government overreach. And this part of the story didn't really make it into the media portrayal because it was all about repudiation and so forth. But to me, the opinion on the Affordable Care Act has changed. It's becoming more pragmatic, and I think as we head into 2016 and the guy named Obama is no longer, you know, on the scene, I think we're into a new era. So groundswell is probably too strong, but I think it's a conversation people are now having, and I'm seeing that in other states. And I think the challenge here in Oklahoma is, you know, you've got one of the nation's, you know, pioneering efforts in Ensure Oklahoma, 70%. Well, you know, I look at what Arkansas did, and frankly, looks to me like there was maybe a little bit of plagiarism there. You know, to be plagiarized is a form of compliment. And the question is, can you put, as I think you can, an Oklahoma face on moving that forward and considering, you know, moving this into Medicaid expansion? What was so striking to me about my experience in spending time with people from Arkansas is the way they were able to frame the Arkansas private option as an Arkansas solution and to engage Republicans and conservatives in the idea that they could take money that was going into Medicaid and instead put it into tax cuts. Now, you know, I'm sure, you know, in Oklahoma, like Minnesota and a lot of other states that I'm in, you know, the idea of that kind of, you know, bipartisan creativity, you know, might find some ears.
Hi. So I work at a community health center here, large one, multiple sites. There was a slide up there that worried me.
Yep.
And you talked about one part of it, but you skipped over the other part, yep. Or you just didn't touch on it specifically. But I think on the national level with the repeal, the whole law thing, it makes sense that that's not as much of a threat. And it also doesn't worry me as much because I'm looking for you to help calm me down a little bit. Maybe you can. Because I think actually the sort of piecemeal, under-the-radar stuff is more worrisome to me, particularly in states like Oklahoma where we haven't fully implemented the law. And in the case of Medicaid expansion, it isn't a case of taking it away.
Right.
It's not yet a reality for so many people. And so am I right to be worried about that? Because you got to remember, the whole dynamic we have here is a very non-compliant legislature that has found, frankly, to their credit, smart ways to not comply, even separate from the Supreme Court saying you don't have to do Medicaid expansion. So, you know, that's what worries me. You know, the funding thing, we're getting a lot of stuff from NAC about the health fund, health, community health center infrastructure funding going down and all that. So do you think there's a real concern? Because I just don't know if there's going to be the appetite here. Now, if there are some of these changes where the governor, I think many of us in this room would be happy that if it was just the case of a letter from the governor and they don't have to go through the legislature.
Yep.
If that could be.
Yep.
But if it is going to have to go through the legislature, I'm worried that if you've got the new Congress saying, well, we're just going to cut funding to implement Medicaid expansion, that it's going to sort of put us farther down the road of it not happening here. So
there are a couple of questions there. There's no doubt you should be worried. If you're worried about cuts, absolutely. That is going to be 2 years of that. And, you know, Senator McConnell and Representative Paul Ryan, who runs the House budget, is absolutely. I mean, the proposal's already been floating around. That's going to be a real push. Now, there are a couple things there. One is, you know, can they negotiate within each chamber? Because the very conservative folks want to go much further than the conservative but more pragmatic types. So they've got to find a way to reconcile that. And then the House is going to want to go further than the Senate. So inaction is a real possibility. But where there is action, it will be on cutting. And I think one of the areas will be the community health centers, which, you know, the community health centers are one of those darlings that you go back over the history. This was, for many years, not partisan. It was, you know, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan and other George Bush, you know, working on, you know, how do you bring care to very poor people? And it's rural, it's urban, and the Affordable Care Act, and before that, the stimulus money has revolutionized these community care, healthcare clinics in terms of what they can do. But the funding ends. And, you know, it's just a kind of a panic about that. I've spoken to those groups a bunch of times, and you know, I think the prospects of that funding continuing are really dicey, because that takes action. And I think inaction will help on some elements of the Affordable Care Act, but we need to take action that's going to be, you know, much more difficult.
We have time for one more question.
Can we get one of our legislator over here? Right. I'm very partial to legislators.
Thank you. Glenn Mulready. Just a quick question. I was curious about your few comments on the lawsuit in the Supreme Court, our Attorney General's. You seem to sort of, I don't want to say brushed over it, but from my viewpoint, if indeed that goes our Attorney General's direction, that really craters the whole thing in 22 states, at least. So could you add to that a little bit?
Yes. This is obviously a big moment, and I think the court case, you know, you could read a bunch of, you know, legal briefs on it. You could kind of look, talk to the experts, and people will have different views to what the court, Supreme Court's going to do. Clearly, there are at least four Supremes who are ready to at least consider striking it down. There are a couple. One thing I just want to mention is the issue on the Affordable Care Act is a particular question within a large area of legal practice having to do with administration. Every law that's passed, pretty much, it's a little strong. Many laws that are passed have ambiguities and contradictions in them. And it comes to the agencies that are implementing them to reconcile those things. And over time, the courts have created a rule, it's known as the Chevron rule, named after the oil company, that allows agencies discretion to administer a law where there's ambiguity or contradiction. Now, the Affordable Care Act says in one of the subsections, in 900 pages, that exchange will be established by the state. And the subsidies are tied, therefore, to states that establish an exchange. Well, it says in other subsections things that tie the subsidies to federal exchanges as well, plus the overall structure of the law is oriented towards expanding access. So the only circuit court that's ruled on this and whose ruling still stands is the Fourth Circuit out of Richmond. And they're reading, and it's a very good, I mean, they really work through just what I've described. Their reading is that the law is ambiguous and that its sections contradict each other. And according to the Chevron rule, this is like a textbook reading of the Chevron rule, you give discretion then to the administrators to figure out, you know, what was Congress trying to do here. This huge body of kind of court cases was used by all sorts of Republican presidents on all sorts of conservative things. So we're focused on the Affordable Care Act, but the point I want to make is this affects a whole lot of stuff. So if the Affordable Care Act is taken down on Chevron, there's a whole lot that we've got to go back to the drawing board on. Now, specifically with regard to what happens if the court comes down against the Affordable Care Act and strikes the subsidies. The key thing here is determining what is a state exchange. That's the key issue. And it turns out that there's a lot of flexibility there for the administration. So right now, and I mentioned this in passing, almost every state is involved in some way, and many in very substantial ways, in running those exchanges. And there's this new category where you've got states using the federal IT system for eligibility and enrollment purposes, and then running the guts of the marketplace, of the insurance marketplace. Things like plan certification, reviewing rates, consumer engagement, and on down the list. Oklahoma is doing some of these things. There are many other states that are doing even more. I mean, a state like Virginia, which has not adopted a state exchange, they have a very substantial insurance regulatory history and capacity, and there's no way in the world, even Republican assembly, was going to, you know, allow that to ship up to Washington. So my point here is the court can give a ruling there, but the court's ruling is never implemented by the court. The implementation will lie in the hands of the administration. Here's one other change that's being talked about that could have a real effect, and I mentioned it as well, that the administration is talking about allowing the governor simply to write a letter to say, you know, we're interested in a partnership or we're interested in using the IT system, that opens the door. And so the court can come down and say, you know, you can't do this for, you can't provide subsidies for states that are only using the federal exchange. The administration may be in a position by June or July when the decision is made to say, okay, you know, these five states can't do it, but these, you know, 45 states are actually now engaged in what we would describe as a supported state-based marketplace. And that meets the law. So that's where it's going. I think the media reporting up to this point has not been helpful because it's created this kind of doom and gloom sense. That is not the reality within the administration and, frankly, with what states are doing, again, on a nonpartisan basis. This is just kind of pragmatic, you know, who runs the insurance exchanges.
Been listening to University of Minnesota political scientist Lawrence Jacobs speaking during last week's Oklahoma Policy Institute luncheon in Oklahoma City. The talk was co-presented by the Oklahoma Scholars Strategy Network. You can find a slideshow of Jacobs' presentation on our website, kgou.org. Our thanks to KGOU's Kate Carlton Greer for recording this talk. For KGOU and Oklahoma Voices, I'm Brian Hartzinski. Stay tuned next for Here and Now with national news headlines from NPR and a local update from KGOU's Mark Antonio Wright.